Would you maybe tell us a little bit to start about your family and the place you grew up?
Yeah. I was a family of 11 people, 11 of us. And my father was a lot older than my mother. It was one of these, in the old days, you know, it was arranged marriages. And where it developed, I don't know, whether it came from the caste system or which England introduced into Ireland, which they got from India. And a part of it. We grew up on a small farm. But by the time the youngest was born, the oldest had left. That was a ways of life with us. And in my part of the country, we had a tradition that the boys had to take care of the girls in their education. And when the men went to England or had to send the money home to educate the girls in the local convent or whatever the case may be. And that is another part of tradition. Some people didn't want their girls to be pot wrestlers, as we say, call here, or skivvies, or housemaids. Well, of course, that was the ways in the older days. As they came here, the women came here to this country as housemaids. And strangely enough, they never went to England. The women never went, they all came to America. Whatever was the tradition, I haven't found it in any book. But that was, and they made a few bucks here, and they went home, and the marriage was arranged because they had a few shillings and a few pounds, a few dollars. And that was handed down. Went down and went down and went down for generations. And there was a book of anthropologists that done a survey of Ireland in 1937 out of the University of Chicago. And it's called The Irish Countryman, and it's a very interesting book. I don't think you ever came across it.
I think they have, yeah.
Yeah. And that gives a lot of the whole issue of Ireland. They set themselves up in Clare, and what prevailed in Clare, and which is 100 miles from me, prevailed in my part of the country too. Mm. And that's one way of... I could go on and on and on. And in growing up, one part of our tradition was storytelling. I was born and raised without television or radios, not newspaper. I mean, we had a weekly newspaper that was about the local district of the county you lived in. Mm. And we grew up with stories, fairy stories, folklore, and genealogy. Your next of kin, second cousins, and all of that stuff. But what fascinated me more was the fairy stories and the folklore of the fairy stories. It left Ireland in 1960 with the television, and nobody believes in that fairy story anymore. But in my part of the country, it was a big tradition of telling fairy stories as kids. When you grew up looking for this pot of gold, if you know what I mean. And through this pot of gold in your mind, you went out into the world and you started looking for that pot of gold. You didn't look for anything but the best, especially the money part of it. if you know what I mean. And that prevailed in a lot of cases, although some of them turned to drinking, and that was another part of our downfall too, but it hasn't prevailed in later years. It has prevailed in my day. I could go on and on, actually.
What was the name of the area where you grew up?
I come on the borders of Mayo and Sligo, and in a place called Tubbercurry. And it's a border town, if you know what I mean, a border in counties in Ireland. It was an insult to ask a man what part of the country he came from, what county he came from. And you'd hear some of them saying, especially the Dublin man, you know, which was right in the city, and what part of Ireland do you come from? And the countryman would turn around, it was dark when I left. Or on the left as you go in, on the right as you come out, will that suit you? So that put pay to him in asking you. And it was a no-no. But here, in this country, it's a part of closeness, if you know what I mean, because we're farther apart, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And what else do you want to ask me?
Was your dad a farmer, or was he...?
He was a small farmer, and in order to make ends meet, as we say, I don't know if you ever heard the word used. Hens meet us just above poverty. We burned lime for the land and for disinfectant, for whitewashing. There was no such thing as paint. We burned the lime and put the lime made out of limestone. And put it into water, and it bubbled up, and you throw it on the walls, and it disinfected every place. And you also had done it for land. Well, during the war, you could get no fertilizer, so therefore you used the lime for the land too, and it sort of loosened up the land if you hadn't used it for, say, 30 or 40 years, you know, it had gone into real hard stuff, heated it up, if you know what I mean. And that was another way of making a living. Quarry the stones, burn the turf. And it was a hard, because you had smoke coming from this, with all the turf and stones and the limestone burning, and you had it 2 or 3 days of torture. You had to go in with through the smoke and put layers of turf and limestone on it, and then it opened up the bottom, and when it was full, you took it out and you sold it. So that was another part. That was seasonal, if you know what I mean. And so, what other else?
Where were you in terms of your siblings? Were you the younger? Or?
No, I wasn't. I was, there was 7 of us before me. I was the 8th. And there's 3 after me, 3 sisters. Mm-hmm. But what happened, the oldest brother, it was a custom, or it was a ways of, it was a must. Mm-hmm. If you know, it was bred that you sent the money home for the girls to be educated. Especially if you had brothers.
Yeah.
That was that was the way in my part of the country. And all my sisters were, 2 of them nurses, and the other 3, one of them came to New York. She came to my aunt. She was only 17, and she'd be the other 2 are at home, one is on the farm, he married a farmer, and the other girl is in Sligo. She was in, I forget what she was doing, but she plays a fiddle.
Most important part.
So, jumping from one thing to another, music was a part of our ways of living. Music, my father was in charge of a flute, fife and drum band. And we have documents of buying fifes for the local fife and drum band from the turn of the century. But our fife and drum band was organized in about 1870. And going back to the Land League movement, if you know what I mean, Michael Davitt and Robert Stuart Parnell and all of these guys that fought for the with Land Leagueism and Fenianism, all the isms that we have. We were all part of it. And that's another part, another story. We call them hard times. Mm-hmm. But you got over it. Paddle your own canoe. But it learned you how to stand up for yourself at a young age. You know what I mean? Go out in the world and mix with people and get a good job, don't get a bad one. Money was a biggie. Get the most money you can. That was from the fairy lore, you know what I mean, as a kid.
Were you working before you left Ireland?
I was working on on the land and burning the lime. Well, I had an older brother, he was taking care of that. My father died in 1945. I was 15 at the time. But they're trying to make a grocer out of me. But sadly, I didn't. They took me out of the business. Because in Ireland at that particular time, believe it or not, you had to do 3 years apprentice for nothing. Which was sad in a ways. You had to work for nothing for 3 years. Have three quarter of a stone of sugar and half a pound of tea and count eggs and you name it. It was slavery. Well, that wasn't the only slavery there was. There was other slaveries too. Sad. It's now that it has opened up completely. Throw the cobwebs away from a lot of these things. That was Ireland. Four on top of the day. I worked for Bournemouth. Foot and turf. If you know what footing means. I guess you know.
Yeah. Tough work, is it?
Huh?
Tough work.
A little tough on the back. Mm. And especially if the weather was damp. We call them midges. You call them something else here in this country. They swarmed you. Especially in the evening. Mm.
When was that? Was that during the war?
We still cut turf. And I left Ireland in 1947. So then I've been back and forth, you know what I mean, for a holiday and all of that. I was 18 and a half. But there was plenty of work in England, you see, at the time. And my brother sent me a letter, and that's how I went there. I clicked in pretty good. Well, of course, when you're working on a farm, you have to. Then you go on, you're on your own. You have to cut it, as we say.
So where was your brother living?
He was living on a farm down in Lincolnshire. And they didn't care too much for us people, for the simple reason that they were all, a lot of them were back there in the troubled times. And they took a hatred from the guerrilla war that we had. And that was one of the reasons that we were, didn't care too much for us. But in England,
sugar in the house.
In England, it was a different. Say, a farmer now, he wanted his wheat taken care of. And he had 60 or 100 acres, maybe 150 acres. And he had beets and he had potatoes. And these farmers had 300 or 400 acres. And of course, at that particular time, food was scarce in England. Yeah, you nearly had to spend half your wages on buying on the black market. And, what we used to do is we'd get a farmer to hire us, and four or five guys would go out as a team, and we'd take on his acreage for so much an acre.
Thank you.
For so much an acre. And we'd try and get it done as fast as we could, and work like slaves to do it, because it was piecework and we were getting so much for the acre. So we weren't thrust in. We made our own deals with them, and then we had the beet, we had the potatoes then. We took on 80 or 100 acres. I worked on 100 acres, and we got so much an acre for picking. And that was a rough job. So I done it for 3 years. That was it. Well, that was only seasonal. Then in winter time, you went on construction.
Yeah.
And construction, you only got paid by the hour, and you didn't get as much money. And of course, the weather had a lot to do with everything else, too.
When you were working on the farms, would you go to different places then, when work finished in one place? Or did you just work for the same?
Well, if the farm was big enough, you held there for at least 6 weeks, 2 months, until the winter came in. But then there was another type of farming in which I had two or three summers, and that was haymaking, hay farming. You were hired on the 22nd of June by a certain place called Bentham. It was away in the Highlands of Yorkshire. And that was the first hiring. And then there was hirings other places. In the 1st of July there was Bentham, Clitheroe, Kirby Stephen. And these farmers had come into town on the certain day that the hirings were, say the 1st of the month. And you'd be there and they come up to you and say, well, is they looking for work? They talk Shakespearean to you. Is the, that's the, it's the cancer. Yeah. And you say, oh no, looking for much, which does they want? Well, you'd know by the, what was going, £40 a month. And some places less, but 40 and 50 was, if the weather was good. If the weather was bad, they had a dial on the wall, and if it said rain, they wouldn't hire you that week. But when they hire you for a month. And if the weather came bad, one thing about them, they were straight. If they didn't have their hay saved in the month, you got your £40. And they might hire you for another week if the weather came up. And I done 3 seasons of that. It was interesting. The last one was Kirby Stephen. That was way out in the boondocks, way up in North Cumberland. And went into the town and hired you on a Monday morning to put you in a buggy and your case and drive you out to the country way to 20 miles out in the, into the hills, nothing but curlews and seagulls. Not seagulls, no. You were too far inland for the seagull. You had the white one, but you wasn't the one from the Atlantic. And you're doing your month there. He had you up at 4 o'clock in the morning if the weather was fine to get this hay by all cook or by crook, in which is a Wexford word for, that's where, what do you call them, came in there, strongbow, by hook or by crook, into water, Wexford, I think, yeah. And you came up with your £40, yeah, he failed you. And you were rich after your month's labour and hibernation, the whole shot.
Were you working with other people from your area at home?
No, the hay farmer was strictly a one-man affair.
Oh.
It was between him and you. Mm. Sometimes he treated you bad. It wasn't all holy. There was a place they used to call it the Halls, and there was, that was the last place you wanted to get hired. The train went in and it had to back out. So you know where you are. When all fruit fails, welcome home. That was the quote. And when you finished with the farm, and it you didn't learn much. You learned what you learned going to school, or you learned what you learned on your own. Mostly how to take care of things, how to take care of the cattle and all of that. That's a part of it. When you get out into the world and you start moving around and you pick up on everything.
What was was the construction work, like the
that was construction, right, yeah. But after 3 years on construction and on farming and all of that, the mines, the coal mines in England, that was a good job. Mm. Of course, for some people it was a bad job. For the simple reason that the government owned the mines. And if you work a full week, say 5 days, you got paid for six. And you also could take on a tunnel as piecework for so much a foot. And that was another way of making a buck. You could make a buck and you could... You couldn't make one, or you couldn't. It all depends on how fast you could get the stuff into you and get it away. But I done 3.5-4 years of that.
Where was that?
I worked in Doncaster in Yorkshire, and I worked in Lancashire. In Wigan, a place called Wigan. Mm. It's an old mining town that goes back to the famine years, where a lot of them came out of Ireland and settled in Wigan. And it was like being back in Ireland. They wore shawls, they wore clogs. A clog, I don't know whether you know what a clog is. No. I have a pair out in the game. Do you know what a clog
wooden
is?
Shoes, is it?
It's a part of a shoe, but it's another individual. Completely different. I'll show you. But clogs were worn during the war quite a lot, and even the women wore them. That's in my part of the country, In Wigan, they were used for a certain purpose. That the clog, they wore the clog two sizes too big for them. So that when they went down the mines and for the coal, they could sit back on their hunkers on the back of the clog, because the clog was timber, had a timber sole. You get what I mean? Mm. And they could work away on that low seam that was in Wigan. But they'd open your head in the morning to hear them blop, 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 going to work in urine. But I never wore them. I never worked the coal face, because there was no money in it. There was more money in the tunnel. But the blasting the rock out for roads and all that stuff.
Were there many other Irish people doing that sort of work?
Oh, the fields, yeah. Mm. Oh, yeah, mostly the crews. Right. You had your own crew, and you move if things didn't work out all right. You told them, shoved them, moved on, and you got another, went to another pit. There's a place in Cork. There was mines in at one time.
Indeed. Out in the Bear Peninsula.
The Bear Peninsula. Mm. Yeah. And a lot of them moved to Butte. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a place in Butte they call it Cork Town. Yeah. And the reason that Butte became so popular, it was founded by a Donegal man by the name of Marcus Daly. And why so many people went to Butte, I had an uncle in it myself, and I had a lot of neighbours in it. And one of the reasons, or two of the reasons, one of the reasons was when it was a dollar in New York, it was $5 in Butte. And another thing about it was, during World War I, with conscription here, a lot of them went to Butte before they joined the army and fight the First World War. And that was another reason then. And things were martial law. That's martial law three times in Butte. We had strike breakers and the whole. It was run by the Anaconda Mining Company, and the King of Belgium was the big chief of these mines. And I used to hear my uncle talking about it. He worked in Butte, and big rows, especially in strike breakers. And the mining company hired gunmen to break these strikes. So the curiosity got the best of me. And my brother went out there in 57. He went out there took painting a cathedral in Great Falls. And I left in January, and on account of my mining in England, I went to work right away in Butte. And it was a different type of mining completely to the mining in very the standard was very bad. But I stayed about four months in it. But I had to come back to Chicago again. It wasn't my cup of tea.
But you went to Canada first.
Went to Canada. They could give that back to the Indians, as far as I was concerned. Although now it's flourishing, I believe. But in my day, it wasn't. It was poverty and it was worse than Ireland. I landed in St. John's, Newfoundland, and I got off there, and I stayed about 3 or 4 days. I wanted to get on to Labrador, but I couldn't on account of being not a citizen. Labrador was going big at the time, and I stayed 3 or 4 years. But the funny thing about Newfoundland, I thought I was back in Ireland. They spoke the same, and they looked the same, and they wore their caps at an angle of 45, the whole works. And they're fascinating people. But the funny part about them, sadly, half of them were illiterate, young fellows. I couldn't believe it. And I used to feel sorry for them. But they were good musicians, some of them. Yeah, I played music with them too. Played a little different to me, but you know, when some of them had the old shoes down pat too. So I jumped the gun and I came to Halifax. And I got a job there. It wasn't too much, 68 cents an hour. Glad to get it.
What, doing what?
I was working in a convent. They were putting an extension onto it. And I had carried over my heavy boots, my hobnail boots with me, and my pants, which was about 24 on the bottom at the time that I was. And they could spot you a mile away. But I was told to get rid of the boots. But they were spoiling the floors with a hobnail. So I worked there for a while, and I thought to myself, Jesus, I was getting more down every day, and I started playing music on the street. And I used to pick up a few bucks, along with the 68 cents an hour, to get my fare farther in the country. I know I had £10 in Monterey Hall, which was all you were allowed to take into the country. And I stopped off in Monterey Hall, and I went down to the Labour Exchange. I got my money down to the currency, the Connard lines, and I went to the exchange, and there was two blocks of a queue waiting to get in. So I thought to myself, I'm not wanted here. So I took, I skedaddled to Toronto. I had the fare paid on the train to Toronto. So in Toronto, very, very sad town. You know, after coming out of England, Ireland, had a whole new atmosphere. You swear you were in Belfast. Unless you wore a ring, an A-frame as we call it. You couldn't get any good job. And there was a strike on. I got in on the railroad. There was a strike with the Teamsters, and I got in and I started working on the railroad, and I got to be a checker on it, but when the Christmas came, bingo, everything stopped. You got laid off and 3 foot of snow on the ground. What were you going to do? Catching squirrels? The idea of coming to the... Everybody wanted to get to the States as fast as lightning. And what you could do at that time until one guy got caught. I escaped it by... You clubbed your money. And as long as you had $400... you could claim yourself into America. And you clubbed your money. When you were only getting 68 or a dollar an hour, it took a while to accumulate, and you had to feed yourself out of the dollar. And as soon as you got it, you put it into the bank account, and you got a receipt from the bank, and you filled out your papers, and they went down, and the next thing you got called. Skedaddled. It stopped after I had left it. A lot of them coming from Ireland at the time. I was in Canada about 6 months at the time, more. And it came in May, and I left in March. And it was a woman that's really done the deed. She came and she threw her $600 in, or I think it was six or four, I'm not sure now. And she was only 6 weeks in the country. And what's happening here? So they clamped down on us then. And at that time, we weren't a part of the League of Nations, if you know what I mean. At one time, I went down to join the police force because I had a pretty, you know, I got a read and studied a fair good education, you know, mostly book education. And I went down to join the police force in Toronto. And this is where the bitterness came in. And he said to me, he said, "What part of Ireland are you from?" I said, "I'm from the west of Ireland, County Sligo." He said, "You're not from the north, are you?" "No," I said, "I'm not." "Well, if you were from the north, I could have you. But if you were from the south, I can't have you." That's how the Orange Lodge operated. Mm-hmm. And that's how a lot of the places in this country, until recently, and mostly in the south, you find a lot of that stuff.
Is that what you mean by the A-frame?
The A-frame means the masonry.
Yeah.
The shake hands. And that all came out of the Orange Lodge in Belfast. And, of course, Toronto was strictly a Scotch town. Very much so. And we were second-class citizens and we were a Catholic. So another beauty is on the mining end of it. Mark, I met a guy in Beauty, Donegal man. He came in 1882 to America. And I asked him about the whole shebang, and he gave me a good rundown on what prevailed. And you seemingly at that time, the Irish, the move from one place to another, well, the Corkmen left Butte and landed in San Francisco, because Corkmen, all of Cork nearly went to Frisco from Butte. And from Leitrim, they went to a place, they went to Oregon. And everybody had their own destination. Because I've been looking up where my part of the country, a lot of them came to Chicago on my father's side. My mother came to New Jersey. And my mother said, "Why and what, and what was the cause of it?" But you're trying to find a common denominator for it, but then you can't get it, if you know what I mean. But the strange thing about it was £5 to come to Canada, and it was 15 to come to New York. That was a big difference in them days.
What year was it when you went to Canada?
53.
And then the following spring?
Following year, I couldn't get out fast enough. I kissed the bridge crossing Niagara Falls.
Is that where you came across?
Yeah, that's where I came across. Although I tried it once. Before, my brother came up to see me. He was in New York. Except for another guy in the land of the crest, and they said, man, we'll take you across the other side. But when I landed in Niagara Falls, they came out before the customs and they seen me. I had a pants or a breeches on me that were 24 on the bottom, and of course that's the first giveaway that'll get you. So I never tried it again after that. Well, I wasn't going to try it, they were.
Where did you go first then in the States?
I lived in New York.
In the city?
No, I lived in a place called Westchester County. And my sister was there and I had a brother there. He was just after coming out of Korea. Because he left in 48 and he didn't, the first thing when he came to America, he was put in the army in 6 weeks. And what happened was, they couldn't get their citizenship until 72. There was a woman here in Chicago that really got that thing passed. Her brother got killed in Korea. I knew her well. And I was sad. You went out to fight, you were an alien, and you came back and you were still an alien. But the law passed then that she was the one that fought it all the way through. What are more questions? You ask the questions and I'll try and answer them. I don't want to be long-winded.
After New York, where did you go?
I went to Florida.
Right.
Yeah.
What were you working at in New York and then in Florida? That's.
I was in the tunnels in New York for a while.
Right.
So I was in the compressed air. Well, I was in the compressed air in London for a while too. My brothers were in today. And compressed air, there was good money in compressed air. If you could take it. If you couldn't take it. I worked in £20, which a lot of people couldn't take it. You know, you had to be in good shape. No cold. And I didn't get the bins. But that didn't. Then there was supposed to be fields are green far away. If you know what I mean. So we went to Florida. And wages bad. Wages were bad. We went there and after this, I worked on the beach in New York too, so I did the sideline, you know, worked the construction during the 5 days. And I was a plain waiter on the out in Rockaway Beach, the place that got taken away with the last. And made quite a lot of money, but make a bum out of you. Everyone wants to buy you a drink. You're a great fella. Play more. Wouldn't give you a nickel, but buy a drink. But that has all changed, you know. So it has. Especially here in this town. Nobody would give you a tip here at one time. But they tipped you in New York. And it's strange how the trend. So What happened was the younger generation era, about 20 years ago, the bottom fell out in New York, and they all drifted in here, and a lot of them were, on the run, aliens, without any character, nothing, John Doe's, as we say. And that's where the tipping began. So they got used to it in New York, and it took off here like lightning. So I bartended here in the 60s in a dance hall by the name James Fuller had it. Two dance halls here. And I done that for a while. Sideline. I almost like sidelines.
What was the name of that? What was the name of that dance hall?
The Caveman's Club. And I forget the one here on the south side. It was at 79th and Halstead. The tips weren't good. $15 a night. For 3 hours. But you had to work your fingers to the bone. What about 400 or 500 people in there? I'm all wanting it right now. A guy said to me one time, "Are your kids like mine?" What do you mean? He said, "They want everything right now," he said. He said, "Back in Ireland," he said, "you had to wait 3 months for a pair of shoes."
Did you come to Chicago after Florida, or were you somewhere?
I came from Florida in here. Yeah. I worked in Florida in a hotel putting beds together, 400 beds. And I worked on another project, but I didn't work too long at it. As a diver, hooking up pipe out in the Everglades. We had to go down and bolt on in the pipe and tighten it up, and you had the whole, you were fed the air from the bank. But the snake problem had a gave me a little scare, and I said, "Adios." I came in here in November. I went to work right away in the tunnels here. I had worked for this Healy in New York before, but here in these tunnels here, no white man worked in them. They were all black. And we were the only two white men that was in them. Well, we stayed there till the weather got fine. And we worked the sewers. Then I became an ironmonger. And actually speaking, I belong to about 10, I think 8 or 10 different unions in my life career. From England to right now. I finished up as an ironworker for 37 years. I was the first one to join the musicians in New York 802 as a piper. There was a guy here by the name of Barry O'Neill, and he was doing research on O'Neill and on the whole shebang, on the music end of it. He said, "You were the first to join the pipers in New York." It cost me $60. But it was good. I was the plain waiter, and I'd work the tables, and I'd go up and I'd play a couple of tunes, and the pipes and the flute, and get tips. Well, New York was good for tips. But it'd make a bummer to you. They didn't give you a tip, they gave you a drink. So, that's another part of my career. Yeah. And that's on the music end of it. We'll go back to the music here. When I was a lad, about 11 years old, my brother, he was an albino. He played the fiddle. And he got lessons from a man by the name of Giblin. He taught flute and he taught violin, fiddle. And my brother had gone to what we call a dancing master that came around in 1935. And he put up shop down the road from us. And that was a part of traveling dancing masters and musicians at the time. But this dancing master, his name was Terry. And he lodged down the road, and his wife had one son, Sylvester. She taught violin. Well, he played the fiddle himself. But on account of the neighborhood being so poor, you had to run dances for him. For, I'd say, sixpence. You know, we had a house dance for him, two house dances. We didn't have much money at the time, that was before the war. And he picked up a bit from that, but then as he got older, he went to this guy in Charlestown, and he taught the flute band in Ballardreen, which was a secondary school, but he also taught the fiddle too, and I took a few lessons from him myself, but I didn't. Bad bicycles at the time, no tires, the war was on, and you had to come to a full stop, and instead of taking out the fellow with the four legs. And you had to, that finished me, but I did get a feel for it, but I never followed it up. I mostly, the old people would tell you, well, Jesus, there's nothing to him. Why is that? He's playing by ear, he's playing by note. You see, this is how tradition goes. People, if you play by note, you don't get the feel of the music. If you play by ear, you put your own feeling into it, if you know what I mean. And that was a part of other experiences that I had during my career.
What other musicians would you have heard playing or learned tunes from in your area or later?
We had the country house dances was the first ways of learning how to play. For the simple reason, if you had to walk a couple of miles to a dance, and you knew who the players, if there was good players at it, you went to it. Well, of course, my brother was a pretty good fiddler, and he was invited. On account of him being an albino, my mother had to send somebody with him. But he could see better in the dark than I could. And that's how I got into the music, for the simple reason, you had fair gusto with the hunger. Now you got, you're lucky to get a cup of tea and a piece of soda bread and a bit of red jam, or, and Of course, that was a delicacy. The red jam. You didn't have it out the country. You might have. You had the butter, but you didn't have the jam. But that again sort of broadens your mind too, for you get along pretty well together, you know, different musicians. Some of them got highbrowed, if you know what I mean. I came from a part of the country where Michael Coleman and Lad O'Byrne and Paddy Kilore and Sweeney and all these guys, mostly fiddlers, Seamus Tansey, and there was quite a few flute players. We had a 5-fiddle drum band that I played in, and that helped to advance my music too. So,
did you play any music while you were in England?
England was a sad place. So was Ireland, a sad place to play music. For the simple reason that in the towns in Ireland, that stuff was throughout the country. And in England, you had to go down on your two knees for to get somebody to play a tune, or to play a tune in a tavern. You're bothering the people. They won't drink. Or else the policemen come in. It's not allowed. There was only a certain part in London where you could busk in the city. And I forget now the name of it. But it went back to the 17th century, the law. In other parts of London, you couldn't play. Only in a dance hall. And some of these dance halls... in London, I played in a place called the Buffalo for a short while. Half and half. Half Irish and half modern, if you know what I mean. You played for the Siege of Ennis and Old Time Walls. And... a short t-shirt and that Scottish one that was about the main ones. Then you had to come down and let the other fellow up. But he had a longer stay than you had. But the best town in England for him, which was quite open, was Manchester. Lincolnshire or any of them towns, Bing, forget it. Even in Ireland. That's throughout the country. Sad. And they were sitting on a pot of gold. And what happened that was, sadly, in 1935... they brought out an act, the Dance Hall Act of 1935, where no country house could have a dance where you paid a fee. And the idea of the country house dance to a lot of people was to support a widow or somebody that her husband died and had kids. And you had these affairs, we call them cops or another slang for a dance, and you gathered in about, say, 40 or 50 people at sixpence, and she bought a bottle of Guinness, and she brought you in the room and gave you the bread and jam and a cup of tea, and that was, you felt like $1 million. You could dance your heart out till morning. That all went. I remember getting caught myself at a dance when I was 8 years of age. taken out by the lug. We call ears in Ireland. Lug is the Gaelic for ear. And get on my way is home. And I never forgot it. It sort of stuck in my mind. And then when I come to think of it, how at the present day, how what has happened, the music has, actually what has happened is that the government has taken it over in Ireland. The government hasn't taken it over here. Have they taken it over here? Not, no way. So you see what I stand on music.
What was it like in Chicago then, musicians? And
so there's a very low esteem when I came here. I came here in 1955, 56. I came here in 1956, and I thought there would be a lot of musicians here on account of O'Neill. I started that there was hardly nobody. Mm-hmm. You could count them on your fingers. And then the Coolies and all of these started coming in, Keegan and the Ostrom Slopes, Kelly Band. And in 1958, we had a convention here, and we formed the Irish Musicians Association of America, and to preserve and our culture, and dedicate ourselves to O'Neill, the man that saved our heritage, actually. And I have talked on stages to that effect too, in a lot of places throughout the years, that only for him we had lost a lot of our heritage. And some people in Ireland are they turn up their nose at me by saying that I'm not supposed to do this. But that's me. I call a spade, if you know what I mean. And but it has progressed. And a lot of the younger people taking it to heart more so. A man by the name of Barry O'Neill. He was born in Toronto, and he was doing research for the Library of Congress way back in the 60s when our music was at a low ebb in Ireland, when they wouldn't play any traditional recordings on the radio or nothing. And they wouldn't even put out a record, a long-playing record, according to some of the tapes that I have by people that try them to. Barry O'Neill told me, I'm only quoting you what I told her. I said, why are you doing this for the Library of Congress on O'Neill? Well, he said, the reason why, he said, there's nothing, he said, in the Library of Congress in America here pertaining to your music, or nothing pertaining to Chief O'Neill of any importance. And he said, it's my, he said, they gave me a grant to do this research. And he'd done a good one. So he did. He went to the graves, and he went to every house that he could but let him in, if you know what I mean. He was a hippie. He had long hair down to his back hair, you know. At that particular time, it was a no-no hair. It was a no-no hair, just the same as when I took out the Bathy Band here. My wife was in the audience. Oh, good God Almighty, look at them. And she said, never mind their looks, listen to the music. And there was another woman, she called me up. She was how people looked at things in concerts. You don't want a bow tie on a dressing uniform and the whole lot of that. And she said, I believe my nephew is coming in, named Kevin Buck. I said, he is, yeah. Would you like to meet him? I would, she said, I would. Oh, stuff from the husband, she was married to a guy from Cabin, landed down and took them backstage to meet them. And I said, this is Kevin Buck now. And she looked at him. Good God Almighty, she said. You're coming to America without a shoe or a stocking on you. And she looked at him, he had a pair of Holland's boot shoes on him. And he was dressed, I won't tell you. But why did you come out to me like that? And he was only young at the time, you know. And I said, that's it. And she was giving him hell. But what do I picked him up at the airport now, just to tell you. Well, I had seen the scene of the folk festivals. You know, I've been in Wolf Trap and a few more places, and I've seen that. And to the Irish audience that's here, they wouldn't, they hadn't seen anything. All the scene was Dickie Bows. If you know what I mean. And when I brought them out here, I had a concert for them on the north side, and I had one on the south side. And I went into them when they were getting ready. Donal Looney, and, Matt Malloy, Kevin Burke, Tina O'Donnell and her brother, and Tina, we had to get her put a dress on her. The dress must be got out of a garbage can. That she had, and this Mrs. Flatley, the mother of Michael Flatley's. And we got a dress for her and put it on her, and she was a good singer and a good player, and what you call marvelous. And I went into them, and I said, I was getting friction from a lot of them. Why aren't they dressed? Why aren't they dressed? Never mind. And I said, fellas, now I said, the only thing I want you to do before you go up on stage, I said, I'm getting a lot of heat now with the ways you're dressed. Will you comb your hair? And I said, okay. So that went all right then, the first night. The second night, I was over here at Bogan High School. And we went up on stage, and they were great anyways, and see, the wife was sitting beside somebody here, and I was sitting beside another guy. His name was Plough. He was good with sayings. And Loney was up there, and his hair was down here. Just coincidentally, he scratched his head, and old Plough, I said to me, he said, there's habitation there. So that's it. And she was on the other. She said, if I hadn't addressed, listen to the music, never mind the dress. And they were great. There was nothing like them. The best that ever came. That heart, that feeling, that everything belonged, they wouldn't. Put what we call the Nya to it. Nya is our nature. And that comes through playing with people that never took a note of music. So that's other experiences of great players, and the public didn't like their looks, but the music was great. And they're still talking about today.
How did you get involved with the Irish Musicians Association? You mentioned that.
The Irish Musicians Association of America. We had a convention here in 1958. And this is another thing of... in 1958, we had people in here from Philadelphia, New York, and Cleveland, and Chicago. And we had a convention downtown. And it was decided on to hold to get a charter. So they couldn't get a charter in New York, they couldn't get a charter in Ohio. So we got a charter here, a man by the name of Geminari here in Blues with the politicians, you know. And we got a charter over Springfield because non-for-profit organization. And we were going strong for 25 years. Nobody ever bothered us. And in order to be, we used to send $1 a year to the people back in Ireland. You know, to keep a good race. Nothing, they wouldn't bother us, or we wouldn't bother them. So, in 1972, a man by the name of Laurus O'Murahu came out here, and I was the first one to meet him, and he told me his business of what he was coming out here for. So, to organize him. And I said to him after the meeting, I said, Laurus, I said, would you like to come out and I show you where Chief O'Neill is buried? And he turned around to me and he said, I haven't time. And that finished me. There it was. He didn't care about O'Neill, he didn't care. All he cared about was himself and his money. So, actually, he influenced a lot of people here, but he's a good fast talker, you know, you have to get that. I don't know if he ever ran into him or not, but he's a good fast talker, he can put his point across if you want to let him. We had a meeting later on with him, which he, an individual here in Chicago, he wanted him to be the chief in this town. And well, I'm a bit like Hogan's dog. I go a bit of the road with anybody. And he rubbed me too far. I said, you go back now, I said, to your own country. He wanted to know how much money we had in the kitty. This is the guy now that's in for 40 years, and nobody has caught up with him. This is the sort of man he is. And he's running the show. He's the same as Castro or Mao. And even my own sister, I tried, she's a fiddle player. She belongs, she goes, she said, I have to. I said, why do you have to? Well, there's no other ways out, she said, it's the way I'd like to get out. And I said, but then I found out that nobody, until he shuts an eye, that nobody can put him out of that office. So, if anybody can tell me anything better, I get the two-year-old occasionally. He has 20 to 30 photographs of himself in every issue. And that tells you something too. So I call it spade a spade. And he's a musician, he can't tell a good joke. We had him here in 1958. That's what he got. He came here in 58. He started, I have the tape. He couldn't get a laugh out of the people, for Christ's sake. Some people that falls for his blarney. And the only people that started that was Sean O'Riordan, was the first guy that revolutionized that with Mishaera. And then he formed the Coolin. He was the brainchild of the whole issue of the tradition. And who was the next one? But he was up to him, it was strictly for peasants, and he brought it into the limelight. He brought the Harpers in with it and all of that Bunting and Pedri and all these. And he done a good job. Pity he died so young. But of course we all have the same problem. Us musicians, drink is our problem. It's in our history books. O'Neill mentions it and everybody mentions it. I don't know why, but it has a toll. But not so lately. I notice a different trend altogether with the young ones. At one time, you figured you couldn't play your music with heart unless you had a few old jars in you. If you know what I mean. And it gave you a spirit. Well, that's gone away altogether.
Was there a lot of music played in pubs then when you first came out to Chicago?
No. In Chicago here in the 70s, there was one on the north side and one on the south side. I played for 9 years in a tavern down the ways here called 6511 South Kedzie. Myself and a man from Sligo town called Sligo Jack. And the Irish musicians, they more mostly cater to for the concerts coming out here. And with the concerts coming out here, I was a part of them for about 3 years until I smelt the coffee, as they say. You had to put them up. You had to feed them. And on top of that, I was told by the headman himself, you had to send back the money that you got at the concert back to Ireland. They send you back for the water too. Don't home free. Well, you done all the work. They collected. Well, nothing for you, only adios, kiss my behind. I see you next year. But I went through all this. So I did. None of the other organized, I'm not bragging or boasting, or you know what I mean? I'm speaking my mind. Because I love the music. And I love the way it's been produced and that nobody's getting exploited. I collected songs too, so I did. I did a lot of songs in my O'Loughlin and songs. I have some book here of, you know, what we call the dance hall or the stage Irishman songs
right.
in this country.
Right.
Some of them were very didn't suit us at all. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
What they call Pat and Mike and all the drink came into it and the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And what else do you have? Songs interest me. You can get a lot of history out of songs, you know.
I do, yeah, I think you can as well, absolutely. That you can trace details.
My brother was the first to compose my Calpine's Fusiliers in 1942. And he composed a few more songs, which was... you know, singing them in pubs.
Mm-hmm. And you have the original words?
There? I have the original words.
There you go. Yeah.
Let me see.
I'd love to see that.
This is a book that was put out in the locality. I sent my sister some of the songs, and this is a guy about two guys about the locality I come from and their experience. A lot of the slang words, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Actually, this is very interesting. But I wanted to ask you about two things you said there earlier on. The first one was when you said it was going big up in Labrador. And was that the sort of, was what was happening? How was word coming back to you that places were, as you said, going big, that I suppose that there were jobs going is
big
kind of...
Big project going.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how did word get back to you about that? How did you hear about that?
You only heard about it when you came to Newfoundland.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Right. And so you would actually hear about different projects from other people who were in...
Oh, you would. The same applied to England, too.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it was all sort of word of mouth, was it?
Word of mouth.
Yeah.
Well, you got the Labour News, too.
Right.
There was a Labour News, a paper that came out, and it states where they wanted men, because actually after the war there was loads of work all over England, but it happened was no good, you know.
Yeah.
Three and tuppence an hour, something like that. Yeah. And songs... There was quite a few songs made with the passport in my hand. There was another song. I don't know whether he heard it. He didn't do it. Some other guy there.
So you don't know who wrote that, no?
I don't know who wrote that. He was a Galway guy. Yeah. Because there was a guy here, I should have taken it down. I left Ireland with my passport in my hand.
The other thing I wanted to ask you was Bute. You were saying that the mining was bad out there. What do you mean by the mining was bad out there?
The conditions weren't up to par compared to England. You get injured very, very fast. There was no. You drove the tunnel and you left the rock here and there. And strange thing at night, the tremor comes on the earth. You find it in the coal mines too. You find rocks in the morning on the road.
Nice.
Yeah, so you don't know where, especially on the night shift. But due to it was hard rock. There was a certain amount of gold in it. But it was copper. The richest hill on earth that it was known at one time.
Were there many Irish working in the mines at that stage when you were out? Or were there even many Irish? Was there much of an Irish community in the town, I suppose?
A lot of them had moved out. Mm-hmm. And if they didn't, they were in the local graveyard.
Right.
Because, for the simple reason, from once you got the mountain con, or silicosis, a year to a day, until you were put in the ground. And I've been in the graveyard there 30 young fellows. Oh, Craigan Cork was a big kid. My uncle worked there. He was a Garden de Valera when he was. So he was. That's what he told me when he died. It was him that gave me the great lowdown. Although on the 4 or 5 months that I spent in it myself, it was winter time. Things were cold. 20 below zero and all that. But you were away from the cold. Mm-hmm. That was one thing about it. Yeah, you were away from the cold. What else do you want to...
You mentioned you were in the unions. Were you ever involved in any... Or how involved were you in... Were you in any strikes, or were you just a member?
I played the war pipes on the picket lines. Mm. To give them morale. And that was a part of my contribution to picket lines. I joined... I belonged to the miners' union. I belonged to the labourers. I belonged to the iron workers. I belonged to the musicians. I belonged to the tug painters. I belonged to the else? I know 8 or 9 during the course of my career. You want to get a job, join up. You might be only in it for a week. But it was all a part of getting there. So I came in here to Chicago. I came into Chicago in 56. I went to Butte in 57. And I came back to Chicago again because it was a booming town. I lived in New York for a year and a half, and it was what we known as doggy dog, if you know what the word doggy dog means. Everybody wanted to get in, and if you couldn't cut it, or if somebody was had a better end than you had, you were down the road. And Canada was the same way as Canada was work. You want to work in Canada for $1 an hour. But in Canada, there was hardly any unions in Canada. And if there were, you had to be a part of the sort of father and son. The same applied here too. Father and son, if you, it's the whole thing. But in Canada, they weren't unionized, especially in Toronto or down east, there was no such thing as a union. And what you did, you went out and you worked. And you got $1 an hour. And Italians were coming in by the boatload. And the Italian would come up to the job, you'd be getting $1 and may work for 70 cents. And you were down the road. So I went down to Tip Top Tailors in Canada, in Toronto. This guy told me that they were trying to organize a union. And I went down and I met the guy. And there was only 10 of us in the union, in the labor union. There was one, he was a Chinaman, born in Canada. And I got to know him, and he said, we have an awful hard time, he said, with these new immigrants, Italians coming over. And he said, nobody wants to join a union anymore. I said, let me get it together. And for the 9 months I was in Canada, and people coming over from Ireland, you know, and England, went down and joined that union for $10. And by the time I left Canada, I had 250 in it. So I heard that some guy from the old country was a big chief in it now. So that's how. I worked in the I worked in the miners' union in England, and the miners had a good union. They went to bat for you, and you got a good 2 weeks pension or vacation out of them every year. And that's where I became more unionized. I did try it one time in Ireland. We were fighting turf. We went on strike. We were only about 16 at the time. For more money, we were only getting 4 and 2 pence. So we didn't get anywhere. So.
How did you manage to get the mining job in the first place? Did you have to join the union before you went to work in the mines, or was it the same thing, like you were the union when you went to the mines? How did you get into the mining thing from the agricultural labour and the construction work?
That was...
Or was it just news of work being available came out?
No, it was work being available, but you had to... You see, in England, you had to do an apprenticeship. But I didn't do it.
Mm.
Because my brother took me down and told them, I had to tell them, I was only about 20, 21 at the time, 20, that I had worked in another mine. And it took them 3 months to find out. So when they got me anyways, they ran me out of the pit. So we had another job, and I told them that I worked in this mine. And that's how I got home free without doing an apprenticeship.
And your brother had worked in mines before?
Oh, he had. Well, I had worked in the tunnels in London too, you see. But the tunnels is a different thing to coal mining.
Okay.
What sort of projects did you work on in Chicago then when you were doing the iron work?
I worked on the whole line. I worked the Hancock and all that. In the summertime, I worked the steel. Because in wintertime, the steel got too hairy for you, as we call hairy. On account of the frost, you couldn't walk the beams. You had to, and you lost a lot of time on red iron, what we call red iron. But on reinforcing and all of that other stuff, on caissons and sheeting, you know what I mean, sheet metal buildings, and you could work the winter time on that, whereas you couldn't know on the Sears Tower. There was weeks upon weeks that they were running paid show up time. And you were down the road working full time. So that's how. But in order to be in the union as the iron workers, you had to be versatile. If an order came into the hall like you wanted connectors, well, that's the hardest job there is, that's setting it. You know, you were on a wing and a prayer and hairy, as we call it, some of the iron shake. when you had it all down pat, you could take any job out of the hall, where more people only could take one particular job. Oh, it helped quite a bit. Some of the guys couldn't get up on that table, if you know what I mean. But it, you know, when you come back to think of it after years, and you see guys taking a dive. And simply, a lot of it was caused by the foreman. He wanted everything done right now. He wanted the building up. He didn't want to wait till next week, just the same as the kid with for a pair of shoes. And the music scene, with our own people, is a strange how some people take to it and more people don't take to it. But with myself now, you see, my father was a great reciter of poetry, and so was my next door neighbour. And actually, I developed a little bit of it from them, and I have a good memory, I can retain it. I got into it more so because it's a dying art, where others can sing, and we're not all John McCormick's. Neil Tobin. He's a good entertainer. He can tell a good story. Oh, you can. Yes, indeed. There were great writers in your part of the country. Man, I have a whole volume by McCartan of 1901, and there's more writers from Cork in the trim volumes of books that I have than in all the other counties in Ireland. What was the reason, I wonder?
Well, I suppose there was a great appreciation for storytelling.
Yeah.
Even inside the city, like.
Storytelling
would be a big thing.
I noticed, I spent a night in Cove in 1960. I was returning. I got married in Ireland in 1960. And I spent a night in Cove. It was a great old sing-song in the pub. And I noticed there was I never seen it in any other place in Ireland, only there. They all sang. Place up in Northumberland too, that was a great place for the same thing. I had a sister living up there. Ah. Baltimore. Where is Baltimore?
Out in West Cork, yeah.
West Cork, huh? There was an incident that took place there where the pirates took a part of the people away.
They did indeed. They raided the village, yeah.
They raided the village, yeah. And there was an old man in my part of the country who used to sing a song about Baltimore. And I would die without a sigh for my kid from Baltimore. Oh, my father, Frank, why that I may thank for being in this sad state. He couldn't endure I've been so poor to marry his daughter, Kate. He said, says he, young man, says he, your folly do give o'er. Ah, this very night I will have your life in the town of Baltimore. You ever hear it?
No, I hadn't heard that one, no.
No.
It's very good.
And of course, Skibbereen was met in this country. A lot of the songs were made, quite a few songs were made.
A lot of people were writing songs as well,
yeah.
In letters, and or notes, keeping it themselves, but some they'd send home as poems and things like that.
Yes.
Yeah. So
I was wondering how it would, you should make a point there.
Yeah.
Ah. Because there was a guy at the University of Chicago this past February, and he sang a song. He said he picked it up in Minnesota. But I heard the song, and I was my curiosity got the best of me. It was in course of time he grew to be a man, and the good old couple died. He left the land or the farm that he had, and the girl to be his bride. God bless the day that he sailed away, seeking for employ, to plow and sow, to reap and mow, and to be a farmer's boy. And I was asking him where he found it, and he said he found it in Minnesota. And my curiosity, was it made in Minnesota and brought back to Ireland, or was it made in Ireland and brought back to Minnesota? Mm-hmm. You get what I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And it's fascinating, though, I would say.
Did you ever think of going back to live in Ireland?
Huh?
Did you ever think of going back to live in Ireland?
No, I didn't. No, there was nothing there when you leave it at a young age, you sort of well, the savage loves his native land, if you know what I mean, and you love to belong to it, but to live in it is another story. Why is hills greener far away? Were we educated enough? That was another part about growing up. In my part of the country, well, we got good basic school education, little geometry and algebra and all of that. But it finished there, where you have money to advance yourself. And if you come from a big family, you couldn't advance yourself to, unless you read the books of life and advance yourself in that was a part of our experience, my experience. I read everything before me and after me. And I think that was good enough to read. I didn't read every Tom, Dick and Harry, because historians, one historian objects the other fellow, his view. And it's just the same as musicians. Everybody takes their own interpretation out of a tune. How you feel, you like it. Does it appeal to you? Does it appeal to others? Ah, it has. If you often wonder me, and nobody could give me an answer, why can a musician put people on the floor dancing? Can you give me an explanation for it? You're up on a stage. You're away from them, you don't talk to them, but you know, you can, they react to you. That's a question I did have to put into their skulls in Cork University when you go back there. But nobody, and I've asked quite a few, and nobody can come up with an answer.
However it happens, I guess that's what's nice about it.
It is, yeah. And it makes you feel good.
It does,
yeah. It makes you feel good, yeah. That's what I mean. Why can't I do this? Why am I doing it? You know, and you don't know it yourself. That's another mystery.
Did you visit back home?
Huh?
You went back to Ireland a few times, did you?
I did. I went back quite a few times. While the kids were in school, you know, I had to hold up here, and then when they all left school, well, I used to go back there every couple of years. The last time I was back there for Michael Flatley's wedding.
Right.
Down in there's a tune in for the town.
Fermoy,
the Fermoy lasses. Marvellous guy. Digging ditches. 10 minutes. 500 million.
Yeah.
I used to come over and I used to play a flute. We used to play the flutes. I taught him how to play a flute. I remember him as a kid playing for fishes here. Come up here. He'd want a certain speed. But one thing about him, he gave you that thing when he danced, that you could feel the things going up your spine as you were playing for him. And to explain it now is a, but I've seen it and I've done it several times, and the approach that he done when he was dancing, and the same thing I used to take him to festivals or gigs, you know, and that split second he could grasp the audience, and he didn't have to say a word, but he done it with his 2 feet and his body. And that is the question that I'm all like to answer. If he can do it with his body and I can do it with the music, and nobody can give me an answer to why. Mm. It's food for thought.
It is indeed. Did you communicate? How did you contact home? Was there with your family? Was it through letters or telegram or?
Through letters. Through letters. It's only in the recent time that we got the computer in. I don't know nothing. I was raised with a candle, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We had no lamp oil. It was scarce at the time during the war. And now we aren't blind. In order to spare it. Do you ever see a sacred hat lamp?
Yeah, yes, yes, yes.
The one with the red light?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, you took the, what do you call it? You took the paint off that, and you...
And that was your lamp?
That was your lamp.
Gotcha.
Spare it.
You wouldn't get much light out of that.
No. In the winter time, it was it was dark at 3:30 in the day, and you got out of school at 3 o'clock. And they landed you with a bunch of sums and dictation and memorizing. And the old routine was spare the rod and spoil the child. That has gone by the wayside, thanks be to God. But sometimes I got beaten myself to a pulp on different occasions. But it instilled in you. You know, if you did get beaten, and they said to me, why did you ever go and see that guy? And I said, I don't know, but he instilled something in me. I would admit, that's another thing. But they did do wrong. They made people stutter. That was the cause of stuttering in our society. There was a guy here, he was going on for the priesthood. I lived with him here, yeah, I lived with different guys, you know, 3 or 4, and talking. How do you get the stammer? To the beating in school. And you never think of the sad things, you always think of the good things. It was good things too. It made men out of us at a young age to go out and hustle for a living.
What age were you when you left school?
Huh?
What age were you when you left school?
I was 15. Well, compulsory is 14, but I went to a technical school for a year. And told you how to grow flowers and all of that stuff. Drive a nail.
You never played any sports, did you?
Not much. Handball.
Right.
Yeah, handball. I never kicked football. No. Mm-hmm.
Alan plays handball as well.
Oh yeah.
Mostly the indoor
court. How I became a handballer was in this Yank, as we say, came over from America during the Depression, and he revolutionized the neighborhood. He lost all his money here, so he set about and he built a ball alley. Organized the people and got them to donate their time and raise money and dances and bought the concrete and put up an alley. The alley took off and it became a great pastime on a Sunday especially. And of course another thing, when you were near it, you learned how to play better. Mm-hmm. So you could make a penny or tuppence. There was no... That was the one game that you could... that there was money in. There was no money in football or hurling. But handball, yeah, there was money.
A bit of betting going on.
Huh?
A bit of betting going on.
No, they're playing.
Right.
Oh, yeah, for the playing. They're playing in the four, you know what I mean.
I do indeed, yeah.
And you put your money up. And, if you won, if the other side won, you won. And money was scarce, of course. You played like the hammers of hell.
Did you play it anymore after leaving Ireland?
I played in New York for a while.
Right.
So I did.
Outdoor alleys, is it?
Huh?
Outdoor alleys, were they?
Yeah, they were outdoor. I played in New Rochelle. They were run by the Christian Brothers. And they had a good ball alley there. But some of the other ball alleys, they were all timber.
Right.
And the wall didn't come back to you as swift as the concrete. And there's a glass alley here in this town. I was at it one time in a place called Aurora, not too far from here.
Right.
Yeah. Played championships. Yeah, during the 30s and the 40s, that was the thing. But the strange thing, you didn't have the shoes. And a pair of boots with a 72 tacks in them.
Because that's some weight to be lugging around the court, isn't it?
And you had sandals in summertime. If you didn't, you had your bare feet. That was a part of the routine. And 1st of May to the 1st of November, the end of September, was no shoes. I had a friend of mine, he came out here, he won the All-Ireland. His name was Dermot Henry, he was a school teacher.
Right.
And he tried to make money on it, but he didn't get any place. He was a school teacher. But like everything else, he had a gin in him for drink. And he was supposed to be a good handballer. Oh, there was quite a few ball alleys in my neck of the woods. But in later years, it didn't. A lot of the guys immigrated and fell by the wayside. But I always liked a game of handball. It appeals to me above any other game.